earth, and the general flattening of experience that happens when we're in the body. Think of every time you've ever experienced disappointment. There is a sense in which all the losses that we undergo here on earth are in truth variations of one absolutely central loss, the loss of heaven. On the day that the doors of heaven were closed to me, I felt a sense of sadness unlike any I had ever known. Emotions are different up there. All the human emotions are present, but they're deeper, more spacious. They're not just inside, but outside as well. Imagine that every time your mood changed here on earth, the weather changed instantly along with it, that your tears would bring on a torrential downpour, and your joy would make the clouds instantly disappear. That gives a hint of how much more vast and consequential changes of mood feel like up there, how strangely and powerfully what we think of as inside and outside don't really exist at all. So it was that I, heartbroken, now sank into a world of ever-increasing sorrow, a gloom that was at the same time an actual sinking. I moved down through great walls of clouds. There was murmuring all around me, but I couldn't understand the words. Then I realized that countless beings were surrounding me, kneeling in arcs that spread into the distance. Looking back on it now, I realize what these half-seen, half-sensed hierarchies of beings stretching out into the dark above and below were doing. They were praying for me. Two of the faces I remembered later were those of Michael Sullivan and his wife Paige. I recall seeing them in profile only, but I clearly identified them after my return when language came back. Michael had physically been in the ICU room leading prayers numerous times, but Paige was never physically there, although she had said prayers for me too. These prayers gave me energy. That's probably why, profoundly sad as I was, something in me felt a strange confidence that everything would be all right. These beings knew I was undergoing a transition, and they were singing and praying to help me keep my spirits up. I was headed into the unknown, but by that point I had complete faith and trust that I would be taken care of, as my companion on the butterfly wing and the infinitely loving deity had promised, that wherever I went, heaven would come with me. It would come in the form of the Creator, of Om, and it would come in the form of the angel, my angel, the girl on the butterfly wing. I was on the way back, but I was not alone, and I knew I'd never feel alone again. Chapter 21, The Rainbow. Thinking about it later, Phyllis said that the one thing she remembered above all else about that week was the rain. A cold, driving rain from low-hanging clouds that never let up and never let the sun peek through. But then, that Sunday morning as she pulled her car into the hospital parking lot, something strange happened. Phyllis had just read a text message from one of the prayer groups in Boston saying, "Expect a miracle." As she pondered just how much of a miracle she should expect, she helped Mom step out of their car, and they both commented that the rain had stopped. To the east, the sun was shooting its rays through a chink in the cloud cover, lighting up the lovely ancient mountains to the west and the layer of cloud above as well, giving the gray clouds a golden tinge. Then, looking toward the distant peaks, opposite to where the mid-November sun was starting its ascent, there it was, a perfect rainbow. Sylvia drove to the hospital with Holly and Bond for a pre-arranged meeting with my main doctor, Scott Wade. Dr. Wade was also a friend and a neighbor and had been wrestling with the worst decision that doctors dealing with life-threatening illnesses ever face. The longer I stayed in coma, the more likely it became that I would spend the rest of my life in a persistent vegetative state. Given the high likelihood that I might still succumb to the meningitis if they simply stopped the antibiotics, it might be more sensible to cease using them, rather than to continue treatment in the face of almost certain lifelong coma. Given that my meningitis had not responded at all well to treatment, they were running the risk that they might finally eradicate my meningitis only to enable me to live for months or years as a once vital, now unresponsive body, with zero quality of life. "Have a seat," Dr. Wade told Sylvia and Holly in a tone that was kind, but also unmistakably grim. Dr. Brennan and I have each had conference calls with experts at Duke, the University of Virginia, and Bowman Gray Medical Schools, and I have to tell you that everyone, to a person, is in agreement that things do not look good. If Eben doesn't show some real improvement within the next 12 hours, we'll probably recommend discussing termination of antibiotics. A week in coma with severe bacterial meningitis is already beyond the limits of any reasonable expectation of recovery. Given those prospects, it might be better to let nature take its course. "But I saw his eyelids move yesterday," Holly protested. "Really, they moved, almost like he was trying to open them. I'm sure of what I saw." "I don't doubt you did," said Dr. Wade. "His white blood cell count has come down as well, and that's all good news, and I don't for a minute want to suggest that it isn't. But you need to see the situation in context. We've lightened Eben's sedation considerably, and by this point his neurologic examination should be showing more neurological activity than it is. His lower brain is partially functioning, but it's his higher level functions that we need, and they're all still completely absent. A certain amount of improvement in apparent alertness occurs in most coma patients over time. Their bodies do things that can make it appear that they're coming back, but they're not. It's simply the brainstem moving into a state called coma vigil, a kind of holding pattern that they can stay in for months or years. That's what the fluttering eyelids are, most likely. And I have to tell you again that 7 days is an enormously long time to be in coma with bacterial meningitis. Dr. Wade was using a lot of words in an attempt to soften the blow of a piece of news that could have been spoken in a single sentence. It was time to let my body die. Chapter 22, Six Faces. As I descended, more faces bubbled out of the muck, just as they always did when I was moving down into the realm of the earthworm's eye view. But there was something different about the faces this time. They were human now, not animal. And they were very clearly saying things. Not that I could make out what they were saying. It was a bit like the old Charlie Brown cartoons, when the adults speak and all you hear are indecipherable sounds. Later, upon looking back on it, I realized I could actually identify six of the faces that I saw. There was Sylvia, there was Holly and her sister Peggy, there was Scott Wade, and there was Susan Wrenches. Of these, the only one who was not actually physically present at my bedside in those final hours was Susan. But in her way, she had, of course, been by my bedside too, because that night, as the night before, she had sat down in her home in Chapel Hill and willed herself into my presence. Later, learning about this, I was puzzled that my mother Betty and my sisters, who had been there all week, holding my hand lovingly for endless hours, were absent from the faces I'd seen. Mom had been suffering from a stress fracture in her foot, using a walker to ambulate, but she had faithfully taken her turn in the vigil. Phyllis, Betsy, and Jean had all been there. Then I learned that they had not been present that final night. The faces I remembered were those who were physically there the seventh morning of my coma or the evening before. Again, though, at the time, as I made the descent, I had no names or identities to attach to any of these faces. I only knew or sensed that they were important to me in some way. One more in particular drew me toward it with special power. It began to tug at me, with a jolt that seemed to echo up and down the whole vast well of clouds and praying angelic beings through which I was descending. I suddenly realized that the beings of the gateway and the core, beings I had known and loved seemingly forever, were not the only beings I knew. I knew and loved beings down below me, too, down in the realm I was fast approaching, beings I had, until now, completely forgotten. This knowledge focused on all six faces, but in particular on the sixth one. It was so familiar. I realized with a feeling of shock, bordering on absolute fear, that whoever it was the face of someone who needed me, someone who would never recover if I left. If I abandoned it, the loss would be unbearable. like the feeling I got when the gates to heaven had closed. It would be a betrayal I simply couldn't commit. Up to that point, I had been free. I had journeyed through worlds in the way that adventurers most effectively can, without any real concern about their fate. The outcome didn't ultimately matter, because even when I was in the core, there was never any worry or guilt about letting anyone down. That had, of course, been one of the first things that I'd learned when I was with the girl on the butterfly wing, and she told me, "There is nothing you can do that is wrong." But now it was different. So different that for the first time in my entire voyage, I felt remarkable terror. It was a terror not for myself, but for these faces, in particular for that sixth face. A face that I still couldn't identify, but that I knew was crucially important to me. This face took on ever greater detail, until at last I saw that it, that he, was actually pleading for me to return, to risk the terrible descent into the world below to be with him again. I still could not understand his words, but somehow they conveyed that I had a stake in this world below, that I had, as they say, skin in the game. It mattered that I returned. I had ties here, ties that I had to honor. The clearer the face became, the more I realized this, and the closer I came to recognizing the face. The face of a young boy. Chapter 23. Final Night, First Morning. Before sitting down with Dr. Wade, Holly told Bond to wait outside the door because she hadn't wanted him to hear what she feared was very bad news. But sensing this, Bond had lingered outside the door and caught some of Dr. Wade's words. Enough of them to understand the real situation. To understand that his father was not, in fact, coming back. Ever. Bond ran into the room and up to my bed. Sobbing, he kissed my forehead and rubbed my shoulders. Then he pulled up my eyelids and said, directly into my empty, unfocused eyes, "You're gonna be okay, Daddy, you're gonna be okay." He kept on repeating it again and again, believing, in his child's way, that if he said it enough times, surely he would make it true. Meanwhile, in a room down the hall, Holly stared into space, absorbing Dr. Wade's words as best she could. Finally, she said, "I guess that means I should call Eben at college and have him come back." Dr. Wade didn't deliberate on the question. "Yes, I think that would be the right thing to do." Holly walked over to the conference room's large picture window, which looked out on the storm-soaked but brightening Virginia mountains, took out her cell phone, and dialed Eben's number. As she did so, Sylvia stood up from her chair. "Holly, wait a minute," she said. "Let me just go in there one more time." Sylvia went into the ICU room and stood by the bed next to Bond as he sat silently rubbing my hand. Sylvia put her hand on my arm and stroked it gently. As it had been all week, my head was turned slightly to one side. For a week, everyone had been looking at my face rather than into it. The only time my eyes opened was when the doctors checked for pupil dilation in reaction to light, one of the simplest but most effective ways to check for brainstem function, or when Holly or Bond, against the doctor's repeated instructions, had insisted on doing so and encountered two eyes staring dead and unmoored, askew like those of a broken doll. But now, as Sylvia and Bond stared into my slack face, resolutely refusing to accept what they had just heard from the doctor, something happened. My eyes opened. Sylvia shrieked. She would later tell me that the next biggest shock, almost as shocking as my eyes opening, was the way they immediately began to look around. Up, down, here, there, they reminded her not of an adult emerging from a 7-day coma, but of an infant, someone newly born to the world, looking around at it, taking it in for the first time. In a way, she was right. Sylvia recovered from her initial flat-out shock and realized that I was agitated by something. She ran out of the room to where Holly was still standing at the big picture window talking to Eben IV. "Holly, Holly," Sylvia shouted. "He's awake, awake! Tell Eben his dad is coming back!" Holly stared at Sylvia. "Eben?" she said into the phone. I have to call you back. Your father is coming back to life. Holly walked, then ran into the ICU, with Dr. Wade right behind her. Sure enough, I was thrashing around on the bed. Not mechanically, but because I was conscious, and something was clearly bothering me. Dr. Wade immediately understood what it was, the breathing tube that was still in my throat. The tube I no longer needed, because my brain, along with the rest of my body, had just kicked back to life. He reached over, cut the securing tape, and carefully extracted it. I choked a little, gasped down my first fully unaided lungful of air in 7 days, and spoke the first words I'd spoken in a week as well. Thank you. Phyllis was still thinking about the rainbow she'd just seen when she exited the elevator. She was pushing Mom in a wheelchair. They walked into the room, and Phyllis almost fell over backward in disbelief. I was sitting up in my bed, meeting their gaze with my own. Betsy was jumping up and down. She hugged Phyllis. They were both in tears. Phyllis came closer and looked deep into my eyes. I looked back at her, then around at everyone else. As my loving family and caregivers gathered around my bed, still dumbstruck by the inexplicable transition, I had a peaceful, joyous smile. All is well, I said, radiating that blissful message as much as speaking the words. I looked at each of them, deeply, acknowledging the divine miracle of our very existence. Don't worry, all is well, I repeated to assuage any doubt. Phyllis told me later that it was as if I were imparting a crucial message from the beyond, that the world is as it should be, that we have nothing to fear. She said she often recalls that moment when she is vexed by some earthly concern, to find comfort in knowing that we are never alone. As I took stock of the entourage, I seemed to be returning to my earthly existence. What, I asked those who were assembled, are you doing here? To which Phyllis replied, what are you doing here? Chapter 24. The Return. Bond had envisioned his same old dad would wake up, take a look around, and just need a little catching up on what had happened before resuming my role as the father he'd always known. He soon discovered, however, that it wasn't going to be quite that easy. Dr. Wade cautioned Bond about two things. First, he shouldn't count on my remembering anything I was saying as I emerged from the coma. He explained that the process of memory takes enormous brain power, and that my brain wasn't sufficiently recovered to be performing at that sophisticated level. Second, he shouldn't worry much about what I said during these early days, because a lot of it was going to sound pretty crazy. He proved right on both counts. That first morning back, Bond proudly showed me the drawing he and Evan IV had made of my white blood cells attacking the E. coli bacteria. Wow, wonderful, I said. Bond glowed with pride and excitement. Then I continued, what are the conditions like outside? What does the computer readout say? You need to move. I'm getting ready to jump. Bond's face fell. Needless to say, this was not the full return he had been hoping for. I was having wild delusions, reliving some of the most exciting times of my life in the most vivid fashion. In my mind, I was on jump run, ready to skydive out of a DC-3 3 miles above the Earth, going to be the last man out, my favorite position. It was the maximal flying of my body. Bursting into brilliant sunshine outside the airplane door, I immediately assumed a head dive with my arms tucked behind me in my mind, feeling the familiar buffeting as I fell beneath the prop blast, watching from upside down as the belly of the enormous silvery plane started to shoot skyward, its huge propellers whirling in slow motion, earth and clouds below mirrored on its underbelly. I was musing over the odd sight of flaps and wheels down as if landing while still miles above the ground, all to slow down and minimize wind shock to the exiting jumpers. I tucked my arms in extra tight in a head-down dive to accelerate briskly to over 220 miles per hour, nothing more than my speckled blue helmet and shoulders against thin upper air to resist the tug of the huge planet below, moving more than the length of a football field every second, the wind roaring by furiously at thrice hurricane speed, louder than anything ever. Passing between the tops of two enormous puffy white clouds, I rocketed into the clear chasm between them, green earth and sparkling deep blue sea far below, in my wild, thrilling rush down to join my friends, just barely visible, in the colorful snowflake formation growing larger every second as other jumpers joined in far, far below. I was flipping back and forth between being present there in the ICU and being out of my mind in the adrenaline-soaked delusions of a gorgeous skydive. I was between nutty and getting it. For 2 days, I blabbered about skydiving, airplanes, and the internet to all who would listen. As my physical brain gradually recovered its bearings, I entered a strange and exhausting paranoid universe. I became obsessed with an ugly background of internet messages that would show up whenever I closed my eyes and that sometimes appeared on the ceiling when they were open. When I shut my eyes, I heard grinding, monotonous, anti-melodious chanting sounds that usually went away when I opened them again. I kept putting my finger in the air, pointing, just like E.T., trying to guide the internet ticker flowing past me in Russian, Chinese. In short, I was a little crazy. It was all a little like the realm of the earthworm's eye view, only more nightmarish, because what I heard and saw was laced with the trappings of my human past. I recognized my family members even when, as in Holly's case, I didn't remember their names. But at the same time, it completely lacked the astonishing clarity and vibrant richness, the ultra-reality of the gateway and the core. I was most definitely back in my brain. Despite that initial moment of seemingly full lucidity when my eyes first opened, I soon once again had no memory of my human life before coma. My only memory was of where I had just been, the rough, ugly realm of the earthworm's eye view, the idyllic gateway, and the awesome heavenly core. My mind, my real self, was squeezing its way back into the all-too-tight and limiting suit of physical existence, with its spatio-temporal bounds, its linear thought, and its limitation to verbal communication. Things that, up until a week ago, I'd thought were the only mode of existence around, but which now showed themselves as extraordinarily cumbersome limitations. Physical life is characterized by defensiveness, whereas spiritual life is just the opposite. This is the only explanation I could come up with to explain why my re-entry had such a strong, paranoid aspect to it. For a stretch of time, I became convinced that Holly, whose name I still didn't know but whom I somehow recognized as my wife, and my physicians were trying to kill me. I had further dreams and fantasies about flight and skydiving, some of them extremely long and involved. In the longest, most intense, and almost ridiculously detailed of these, I found myself in a South Florida cancer clinic featuring outdoor escalators where I was pursued by Holly, two South Florida police officers, and a pair of Asian ninja photographers on cable pulleys. I was, in fact, going through something called ICU psychosis. It's normal, even expected, for patients whose brains are coming back online after being inactive for a long period. I'd seen it many a time, but never from the inside. And from the inside, it was very, very different indeed. The most interesting thing about this session of nightmares and paranoid fantasies, in retrospect, is that all of it was indeed that, a fantasy. Portions of it, in particular the extended South Florida ninja nightmare, were extremely intense, and even outright terrifying while happening. But in retrospect, indeed almost immediately after this period ended, it all became clearly recognizable as what it was, something cooked up by my very beleaguered brain as it was trying to recover its bearings. Some of the dreams I had during this period were stunningly and frighteningly vivid, but in the end they served only to underline how very, very dissimilar my dream state had been compared with the ultra-reality deep in coma. As for the rockets, airplanes, and skydiving themes that I imagined so consistently, they were, I later realized, quite accurate from a symbolic point of view. Because the fact was that I was making a dangerous reentry from a place far away to the abandoned but now once again functional space station of my brain. One could hardly ask for a better earthly analogy for what happened to me during my week out of body than a rocket launch. Chapter 25. Not There Yet. Bond wasn't the only one having difficulty accepting the decidedly kooky person I was during those first days back. The day after I recovered consciousness, Monday, Phyllis called Eben the Fourth on his computer using Skype. "Eben, here's your dad," she said, turning the video camera toward me. "Hi, Dad, how's it going?" he said cheerfully. For a minute, I just grinned and stared at the computer screen. When I finally spoke, Eben was crushed. I was painfully slow in my speech, and the words themselves made little sense. Eben later told me, "You sounded like a zombie, like someone on a bad acid trip." Unfortunately, he had not been forewarned about the possibility of an ICU psychosis. Gradually, my paranoia abated, and my thinking and conversation became more lucid. 2 days after my awakening, I was transferred to the neuroscience step-down unit. The nurses there gave Phyllis and Betsy cots so that they could sleep next to me. I trusted no one but the two of them. They made me feel safe, tethered to my new reality. The only problem was that I didn't sleep. I kept them up all night going on about the internet, space stations, Russian double agents, and all manner of related nonsense. Phyllis tried to convince the nurses that I had a little cough, hoping a little cough syrup would bring on an hour or so of uninterrupted sleep. I was like a newborn who did not adhere to a sleep schedule. In my quieter moments, Phyllis and Betsy helped pull me slowly back to earth. They recalled all kinds of stories from our childhood, and though by and large I listened as if I were hearing them for the first time, I was fascinated all the same. The more they talked, the more something important began to glimmer inside me. The realization that I had, in fact, been there for these events myself. Very quickly, both sisters told me later, the brother they had known became visible again through the thick fog of paranoid chatter. "It was amazing," Betsy later told me. "You were just coming out of coma. You weren't at all fully aware of where you were or what was going on. You talked about all kinds of crazy stuff half the time, and yet your sense of humor was just fine. It was obviously you. You were back." "One of the first things you did was crack a joke about feeding yourself," Phyllis later confided. "We were prepared to have fed you spoonful by spoonful for as long as it took, but you'd have none of it. You were determined to get that orange jello into your mouth on your own." As the temporarily stunned engines of my brain kicked back in ever further, I would watch myself say or do things and marvel, "Where did that come from?" Early on, a Lynchburg friend named Jackie came by to visit. Holly and I had known Jackie and her husband Ron well, having bought our house from them. Without my willing them to do so, my deeply ingrained Southern social graces kicked in. Seeing Jackie, I immediately asked, "How's Ron?" After a few more days, I started having occasional, genuinely lucid conversations with my visitors. And again, it was fascinating to see how much of these connections were automatic and did not require much effort on my part. Like a jet on autopilot, my brain somehow negotiated these increasingly familiar landscapes of human experience. I was getting a first-hand demonstration of a truth that I'd known very well as a neurosurgeon. The brain is a truly marvelous mechanism. Of course, the unspoken question on everybody's mind, including mine in my more lucid moments, was, how well would I get? Was I really returning in full, or had the E. coli done at least some of the damage all the doctors had been sure it would do? This daily waiting tore at everyone, especially Holly, who feared that all of a sudden the miraculous progress would stop, and she would be left with only a portion of the me she had known. Yet day by day, ever more of that me returned. Language, memories, recognition, a certain mischievous streak I've always been known for returned as well. And while they were pleased to see my sense of humor back, my two sisters weren't always thrilled with how I chose to use it. Monday afternoon, Phyllis touched my forehead, and I recoiled. "Ouch!" I screamed. "That hurts!" Then, after enjoying everybody's horrified expressions, I said, "Just kidding." Everyone was surprised by the speed of my recovery, except for me. I, as of yet, had no real clue how close to death I had actually been. As one by one, friends and family headed back to their lives, I wished them well and remained blissfully ignorant of the tragedy that had been so narrowly averted. I was so ebullient that one of the neurologists who evaluated me for rehab placement insisted that I was too euphoric and that I was probably suffering from brain damage. This doctor, like me, was a regular bow tie wearer, and I returned the favor of his diagnosis by telling my sisters, after he had left, that he was strangely flat of affect for a bow tie aficionado. Even then, I knew something that more and more of the people around me would come to accept as well. Doctor's views or no doctor's views, I wasn't sick or brain damaged. I was completely well. In fact, though at this point only I knew this, I was completely and truly well for the first time in my entire life. Chapter 26, Spreading the News. Truly well, even if I did still have some work to do as far as the hardware side of things went. A few days after moving to outpatient rehab, I called Eben the Fourth at school. He mentioned that he was working on a paper in one of his neuroscience courses. I volunteered to help, but soon regretted doing so. It was much harder for me to focus on the subject than I had expected, and terminology I thought I had fully back suddenly refused to come to my mind. I realized with a shock just how far I still had to go. But bit by bit, that part came back too. I'd wake up one day and find myself in possession of whole continents of scientific and medical knowledge that the day before I had been without. It was one of the strangest aspects of my experience, opening my eyes in the morning with even more of the nuts and bolts of a whole lifetime of education and experience at work again. While my neuroscientist knowledge crept back slowly and timidly, my memories of what had happened during that week out of my body loomed in my memory with astonishing boldness and clarity. What had happened outside the earthly realm had everything to do with the wild happiness I'd awakened with, and the bliss that continued to stick with me. I was deliriously happy because I was back with the people I loved, but I was also happy because, to state the matter as plainly as I can, I understood for the first time who I really was and what kind of a world we inhabit. I was wildly and naively eager to share these experiences, especially with my fellow doctors. After all, what I had undergone altered my long-held beliefs of what the brain is, what consciousness is, even what life itself means and doesn't mean. Who wouldn't be anxious to hear of my discoveries? Quite a few people, as it turned out, most especially people with medical degrees. Make no mistake, my doctors were very happy for me. "That's wonderful, Eben," they would say, echoing my response to countless patients of my own who, in the past, had tried to tell me about otherworldly experiences they'd undergone during surgery. "You are very sick. Your brain was soaking in pus. We can't believe you're even here to talk about it. You know yourself what the brain can come up with when it's that far gone." In short, they couldn't wrap their minds around what I was so desperately trying to share. But then, how could I blame them? After all, I certainly wouldn't have understood it either, before. Chapter 27, Homecoming. I came home on November 25, 2008, 2 days before Thanksgiving, to a home full of gratitude. Eben the Fourth drove overnight to surprise me the following morning. The last time he'd been with me, I'd been in full coma, and he was still processing the fact that I was alive at all. He was so excited that he got a speeding ticket coming through Nelson County just north of Lynchburg. I'd been up for hours, sitting in my easy chair by the fire in our cozy wood-paneled study, just thinking about everything I'd been through. Eben walked through the door just after 6 a.m. I stood up and gave him a long hug. He was stunned. The last time he'd seen me on Skype in the hospital, I've been barely able to form a sentence. Now, other than still being on the thin side and having an IV line in my arm, I had returned to my favorite role in life, being Eben and Bond's dad. Well, almost the same. Eben was aware of something else that was different about me, too. Later, Eben would say that when he first saw me that day, he was immediately taken with how present I was. "You were so clear, so focused," he said. "It was as if there was a kind of light shining within you." I wasted no time in sharing my thoughts. "I am so eager to read all I can about this," I told him. "It was all so real, Eben, almost too real to be real, if that makes any sense. I want to write about it for other neuroscientists, and I want to read up on NDEs and what other people have experienced. I can't believe I never took any of it seriously, never listened to what my own patients told me. I was never curious enough to even look into any of the literature." Eben didn't say anything at first, but it was clear he was thinking about how to best advise his dad. He sat down across from me, and he urged me to see what should have been obvious. "I believe you, Dad," he said, "but think about it. If you want this to be of value to others, the last thing you should do is read what other people have said." "So what should I do?" I asked. "Write it down. Write it all down. All your memories as accurately as you can remember them. But don't read any books or articles about other people's near-death experiences, or physics, or cosmology. Not until you've written down what happened to you. Don't talk to Mom or anyone else about what happened while you were in coma either, at least to the degree that you can steer clear of it. You can do that all you want later, right? Think how you always used to tell me that observation comes first, then interpretation. If you want what happened to you to be scientifically valuable, you need to record it as purely and accurately as you can before you start making any comparisons with what has happened to others. It was perhaps the most sage advice anyone's ever given me, and I followed it. Eben was also quite right that what I deeply wanted, more than anything else, was to use my experiences to hopefully help others. The more my scientific mind returned, the more clearly I saw how radically what I'd learned in decades of schooling and medical practice conflicted with what I'd experienced. The more I understood that the mind and the personality, as some would call it, our soul or spirit, continue to exist beyond the body, I had to tell my story to the world. For the next 6 weeks or so, most days went the same. I'd wake up around 2 or 2:30 a.m., feeling so ecstatic and energized by simply being alive that I would bound out of bed. I'd light a fire in the den, sit down in my old leather chair, and write. I tried to recall every detail of my journeys in and out of the core, and what I had felt as I learned its many life-changing lessons. Though tried isn't really the right word. Crisp and clear, the memories were right there, right where I had left them. Chapter 28, The Ultra Real. There are two ways to be fooled. One is to believe what isn't true. The other is to refuse to believe what is true. Soren Kierkegaard, 1813 to 1855. In all this writing, one word seemed to come up again and again. Real. Never before my coma had I realized just how deceptive a word can be. The way I had been taught to think about it, both in medical school and in that school of common sense called life, is that something is either real, a car accident, a football game, a sandwich on the table in front of you, or it's not. In my years as a neurosurgeon, I'd seen plenty of people undergo hallucinations. I thought I knew just how terrifying unreal phenomena could be to those experiencing them. And during my few days of ICU psychosis, I'd had a chance to sample some impressively realistic nightmares as well. But once they passed, I quickly recognized those nightmares for the delusions they were. Neuronal phantasmagoria stirred up by brain circuitry struggling to get running again. But while I was in coma, my brain hadn't been working improperly. It hadn't been working at all. The part of my brain that years of medical school had taught me was responsible for creating the world I lived and moved in, and for taking the raw data that came in through my senses and fashioning it into a meaningful universe, that part of my brain was down and out. And yet, despite all of this, I had been alive and aware, truly aware, in a universe characterized above all by love, consciousness, and reality. There was that word again. There was, for me, simply no arguing this fact. I knew it so completely that I ached. What I'd experienced was more real than the house I sat in, more real than the logs burning in the fireplace. Yet there was no room for that reality in the medically trained scientific worldview that I'd spent years acquiring. How was I going to create room for both of these realities to coexist? Chapter 29, A Common Experience. Finally, the day came when I had written down everything I could, every last memory of the realm of the earthworm's eye view, the gateway, and the core. Then it was time to read. I plunged into the ocean of NDE literature, an ocean into which I'd never so much as dipped a toe before. It didn't take me long to realize that countless other people had experienced the things I had, both in recent years and centuries past. NDEs are not all the same. Each one is unique, but the same elements show up again and again, and many I recognize from my own experience. Narratives of passing through a dark tunnel or valley into a bright and vivid landscape, ultra-real, were as old as ancient Greece and Egypt. Angelic beings, sometimes winged, sometimes not, went back at least to the ancient Near East, as did the belief that such beings were guardians who watched the activities of people on Earth and greeted those people when they left it behind. The sense of being able to see in all directions simultaneously, the sensation of being above linear time, of being above everything, essentially, that I had previously thought of as defining the landscape of human life, the hearing of anthem-like music which entered through one's whole being rather than simply one's ears, the direct and instantaneous reception of concepts that normally would have taken a very long time and a great deal of study to comprehend without any struggle whatsoever. Feeling the intensity of unconditional love. Over and over in the modern NDE accounts and in spiritual writings from earlier times, I'd feel the narrator struggling with the limitations of earthly language, trying to get the entirety of the fish they had hooked on board the boat of human language and ideas, and always, to one degree or another, failing. And yet, with each attempt that fell frustratingly short of its goal, each person straining at language and ideas to get this enormity across to the reader, I'd understand the aim of the storyteller and what they'd hoped to convey in all of its boundaryless majesty, but simply couldn't. Yes, 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 I'd say to myself as I read, I understand. These books, this material, had all, of course, been there before my experience, but I'd never looked at it. Not just in terms of reading, but in another way as well. Quite simply, I'd never held myself open to the idea that there might be anything genuine to the idea that something of us survives the death of the body. I was the quintessential good-natured, albeit skeptical, doctor. And as such, I can tell you that most skeptics aren't really skeptics at all. To be truly skeptical, one must actually examine something and take it seriously. And I, like many doctors, had never taken the time to explore NDEs. I had simply known they were impossible. I also went through the medical records of my time in coma, a time that was meticulously recorded, practically from the very start. Reviewing my scans just as I would have for a patient of my own, it became clear to me at last just how fantastically sick I had been. Bacterial meningitis is unique among diseases in the manner in which it attacks the outer surface of the brain while leaving its deeper structures intact. The bacteria efficiently wreck the human part of our brain first and finally prove fatal by attacking the deeper housekeeping structures common to other animals deep beneath the human part. The other conditions that can damage the neocortex and cause unconsciousness, head trauma, stroke, brain hemorrhages, or brain tumors, are not nearly as efficient at completely damaging the entire surface of the neocortex. These tend to involve only part of the neocortex, leaving other parts unscathed and able to function. Not only that, but instead of taking the neocortex alone out, they tend to also damage the deeper and more primitive parts of the brain as well. Given all of this, bacterial meningitis is arguably the best disease one could find if one were seeking to mimic human death without actually bringing it about. Though, of course, it usually does. The sad truth is that virtually everyone as sick as I was from bacterial meningitis never returns to tell the tale. Please refer to Appendix A. Though the experience is as old as history, the near-death experience, regardless of whether it was seen as something real or a baseless fantasy, only became a household term fairly recently. In the 1960s, new techniques were developed that allowed doctors to resuscitate patients who had suffered a cardiac arrest. Patients who in former times simply would have died were now pulled back into the land of the living. Unbeknownst to them, these physicians were, through their rescue efforts, producing a breed of trans-earthly voyagers, people who had glimpsed beyond the veil and returned to tell about it. Today they number in the millions. Then, in 1975, a medical student named Raymond Moody published a book called Life After Life, in which he described the experience of a man named George Ritchie. Ritchie had died as a result of cardiac arrest, as a complication of pneumonia, and been out of his body for 9 minutes. He traveled down a tunnel, visited heavenly and hellish regions, met a being of light that he identified as Jesus, and experienced feelings of peace and well-being that were so intense he had difficulty putting them into words. The era of the modern near-death experience was born. I couldn't claim complete ignorance of Moody's book, but I had certainly never read it. I didn't need to, because I knew, first of all, that the idea that cardiac arrest represented some kind of close-to-death condition was nonsense. Much of the literature about near-death experiences concerns patients whose hearts stop for a few minutes, usually after an accident or on the operating table. The idea that cardiac arrest constitutes death is outdated by about 50 years. Many lay people still believe that if someone comes back from cardiac arrest, then they have died and returned to life. But the medical community long ago revised its definitions of death to center on the brain, not the heart. Ever since brain death criteria, which rely on crucial findings of the patient's neurological examination, were established in 1968. Cardiac arrest is relevant to death only in terms of its effect on the brain. Within seconds of cardiac arrest, cessation of blood flow to the brain leads to widespread disruption of cooperative neural activity and loss of consciousness. For half a century, surgeons have routinely stopped the heart for minutes to hours in cardiac surgery and occasionally neurosurgery, using cardiopulmonary bypass pumps, and sometimes cooling the brain to enhance its viability under such stresses. No brain death occurs. Even a person whose heart stops on the street might be spared brain damage, provided that someone starts performing cardiopulmonary resuscitation within 4 minutes and the heart can eventually be restarted. As long as oxygenated blood travels to the brain, and therefore the person, will stay alive, albeit transiently unconscious. This piece of knowledge was all I needed to discount Moody's book without ever opening it. But now I did open it, and reading the stories Moody reported with the reference of what I myself had gone through made me completely shift my perspective. I had little doubt that at least some of the people in these stories had genuinely left their physical bodies. The similarities with what I myself had experienced beyond the body were simply too overwhelming. The more primitive parts of my brain, the housekeeping parts, functioned for all or most of my time in coma. But when it came to the part of my brain that every single brain scientist will tell you is responsible for the human side of me, well, that part was gone. I could see it on the scans, in the lab numbers, on my neurological exams, and all the data from my very closely recorded week in hospital. I quickly began to realize that mine was a technically near-impeccable near-death experience, perhaps one of the most convincing such cases in modern history. What really mattered about my case was not what happened to me personally, but the sheer flat-out impossibility of arguing from a medical standpoint that it was all fantasy. Describing what an NDE is challenging at best, but doing so in the face of a medical profession that refuses to believe it's possible at all makes it even harder. Due to my career in neuroscience and my own NDE, I now have the unique opportunity to make it more palatable. Chapter 30. Back from the Dead. And the drawing near of death, which alike levels all, alike impresses all with a last revelation, which only an author from the dead could adequately tell. Herman Melville, 1819 to 1891. Everywhere I went in those first few weeks, people looked at me like I had risen from the grave. I ran into one doctor who had been present at the hospital the day I'd come in. He hadn't been directly involved in my care, but he'd gotten a good eyeful when I was rolled into the ER that first morning. "How can you even be here?" he asked, summarizing the medical community's basic question about me. "Are you Eben's twin brother or what?" I smiled, reached out, and shook his hand firmly to let him know it was really I. Though he was, of course, joking about whether I had a twin brother, this doctor was actually making an important point. For all intents and purposes, I still was two people, and if I was going to do what I had told Eben the Fourth I wanted to do, use my experience to help others, I would have to reconcile my NDE with my scientific understanding and knit those two people together. My memory went back to a phone call I'd received one morning several years before, from the mother of a patient who'd called as I was examining a digital map of a tumor I was to remove later that day. I'll call the woman Susanna. Susanna's late husband, whom I will call George, had been a patient of mine with a brain tumor. In spite of everything we did, he died within a year and a half of diagnosis. Now Susanna's daughter was ill with several brain metastases from breast cancer. Her prospects of survival beyond a few months were remote. It wasn't a good time to take a call. My mind was completely absorbed in the digital image in front of me and with mapping out exactly what my strategy was going to be to go in and remove it without doing damage to the brain tissue around it. But I stayed on the line with Susanna because I knew that she was trying to think of something, anything, to allow her to cope. I'd always believed that when you're under the burden of a potentially fatal illness, softening the truth is fine. To prevent a terminal patient from trying to grab onto a little fantasy to help them deal with the possibility of death is like withholding pain-killing medication. It was an extraordinarily heavy load to carry, and I owed Susanna every second of attention she asked. "Dr. A," Susanna said, "my daughter had the most incredible dream. Her father came to her in it. He told her everything was going to be all right, that she didn't need to worry about dying." It was the kind of thing I'd heard from patients countless times, the mind doing what it can to soothe itself in an unbearably painful situation. I told her it sounded like a wonderful dream. "But the most incredible thing, Dr. A, is what he was wearing, a yellow shirt and a fedora." "Well, Susanna," I said good-naturedly, "I guess there are no dress codes in heaven." "No," Susanna said, "that's not it. Early on in our relationship, when we were first dating, I gave George a yellow shirt. He liked to wear it with a fedora that I also gave him, but the shirt and hat were lost when our luggage failed to arrive on our honeymoon. He already knew by that time how much I loved him in that shirt and hat, but we never replaced them." "I'm sure Christina had heard lots of wonderful stories about that shirt and hat, Susanna," I said, "and about your early times together." "No," she laughed, "that's what's so wonderful. That was our little secret. We knew how ridiculous it would sound to someone else. We never talked about that shirt and fedora after they were lost. Christina never heard one peep from us about them. Christina was so afraid of dying, and now she knows she has nothing to fear, nothing at all." What Susanna was telling me, I discovered in my reading, was a variety of dream confirmation that happens quite often. But I hadn't had my NDE when I'd gotten that call, and at the time I knew perfectly well that what Susanna was telling me was a grief-induced fantasy. Over the course of my career, I had treated many patients who had undergone unusual experiences while in coma or during surgery. Whenever one of these people narrated an unusual experience like Susanna's, I was always completely sympathetic, and I was quite sure these experiences had indeed happened in their minds. The brain is the most sophisticated and temperamental organ we possess. Tinker around with it, lessen the degree of oxygen it gets by a few torr, a unit of pressure, and the owner of that brain is going to experience an alteration in their reality, or more precisely, their personal experience of reality. Throw in all the physical trauma and all the medications that someone with a brain malady is likely to be on, and you have a virtual guarantee that, should a patient have any memories when they come back around, those memories are going to be pretty unusual. With a brain affected by a deadly bacterial infection and mind-altering medications, anything could happen. Anything, that is, except the ultra-real experience I had in coma. Susanna, I realized with the kind of jolt that comes when you see something that should have been obvious, wasn't calling to be comforted by me that day. She really and truly was trying to comfort me. But I hadn't been able to see that. I thought I was doing Susanna a kindness by pretending, in my wan, distracted way, to believe her story. But I wasn't. And looking back on that conversation, and dozens of others like it, I realized just what a long road I had in front of me if I was going to convince my fellow doctors that what I had been through was real. Chapter 31. Three Camps. I maintain that the human mystery is incredibly demeaned by scientific reductionism, with its claim in promissory materialism to account eventually for all of the spiritual world in terms of patterns of neuronal activity. This belief must be classed as a superstition. We have to recognize that we are spiritual beings with souls existing in a spiritual world, as well as material beings with bodies and brains existing in a material world. Sir John C. Eccles, 1903-1997. When it came to NDEs, there were three basic camps. There were the believers, either people who had undergone an NDE themselves or who simply found such experiences easy to accept. Then, of course, there were the staunch unbelievers, like the old me. These people didn't generally classify themselves as unbelievers, however. They simply knew that the brain generated consciousness and wouldn't hold still for crazy ideas of mind beyond the body, unless they were good-naturedly comforting someone, as I had thought I'd been doing with Susanna that day. Then there was the middle group. In here, there were all kinds of people who had heard about NDEs, either by reading about them or, because they're extraordinarily common, by having a friend or relative who had undergone one. These people in the middle were the ones my story could really help. The news that NDEs bring is life-transforming, but when a person who is potentially open to hearing about an NDE asks a doctor or a scientist, in our society the official gatekeepers on the matter of what's real and what isn't, they are all too often told, gently but firmly, that NDEs are fantasies, products of a brain struggling to hold on to life, and nothing more. As a doctor who'd undergone what I had, I could tell a different story. And the more I thought about it, the more I felt I had a duty to do just that. One by one, I ran down the suggestions that I knew my colleagues and I myself in the old days would have offered to explain what happened to me. Refer to my Summary of Neuroscientific Hypotheses, Appendix B. Was my experience a primitive brainstem program that evolved to ease terminal pain and suffering, possibly a remnant of feigned death strategies used by lower mammals? I discounted that one right out of the gate. There was, quite simply, no way that my experiences, with their intensely sophisticated visual and oral levels, and their high degree of perceived meaning were the product of the reptilian portion of my brain. Was it a distorted recall of memories from deeper parts of my limbic system, the part of the brain that fuels emotional perception? Again, no. Without a